Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into IRIS today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, November 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Turning to the front page of the Courier, the lead story is titled A Life at the Museum. Billy Bailey retires after 43-year career with the Grout, 33 as the executive director. This story was filed by Melody Parker, and the dateline is Waterloo. Billy Bailey has led the Grout Museum District through decades of growth and expansion in its facilities and programming. Now, after more than 33 years as executive director and 43 years in museum work, Bailey is retiring. Her last day is December 15th, and she's ready. Quote, "Everyone told me, you'll know when it's time to retire. And they were right. It feels like time. I'm ready," said Bailey. Quote, "I'll miss being here, and I'll miss the people. I've been fortunate to work with so many great people over the years, but I'm looking forward to sleeping in, no meetings, and spending time with my granddaughter," unquote. There will be an open house from 4 to 6 p.m. on December 5th in the museum's mess hall to celebrate Bailey's 43 years of dedication and commitment to the district. Her list of accomplishments is a lengthy one, including procuring funding and overseeing the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum addition and Voices of Iowa Oral History Project, and securing the votes of Waterloo residents to pass the cultural and scientific facilities levy. Quote, "We are recipients and caretakers of this community's history and heritage, its tangible objects. It's an important job and not to be taken lightly," Bailey said. She's particularly proud of the $11 million, 30,000 square foot Veterans Museum, named for the five Sullivan brothers who died when the USS Juno sank during World War II. The museum opened on November 15th of 2008, preserving the history of Iowans at war from the Civil War to the present. There was some urgency as well, Bailey said. Quote, "The goal was to preserve history. The World War II generation was leaving us at a rapid pace, and this was our one chance to make a first impression. It had to be good. We opened it on or under budget and had national press coverage. The museum draws visitors from around the country." Quote, "It's still gratifying to read reviews and comments in the guest book. By and large, comments are positive, and some visitors have said it's as good as the Smithsonian. That makes us proud," Bailey explained. Videos from the Voices of Iowa archive, one of the largest veteran collections of interviews conducted by a single institution in the nation, are meaningful and often used at veterans' funerals. The collection has been expanded to include stories from Iowa farm families. In 1990, Bailey oversaw the $1.5 million Grout Museum expansion that nearly doubled its size and offered three new exhibition halls, an activity room, a 200-seat conference center, gift shop, and an elevator. As director, she also has led the museum through the refurbishment and naming of the Norris Corson Planetarium, establishing the Carl A. and Peggy J. Bluedorn Science Imaginarium, and establishing and expanding the Grouts Museum School, which began 25 years ago. The school provides programming and activities for every third-grade student in Black Hawk County, emphasizing Iowa history. The Snowden House joined the Rensselaer Russell House Museum as historic jewels in the Grout Museum District. Bailey coordinated with Grout Historic Houses and Jim Aronson Interior Design to update the Snowden House, which is a popular gathering place for civic organizations as well as weddings and anniversary parties. Quote, "We have a supportive board willing to take advantage of opportunities," she said. Bailey began working at the museum as its first intern in 1979. Quote, I grew up on a dairy farm near Grinnell, and we didn't take traditional family vacations. A lot of our family trips were climbing in the car and driving somewhere in Iowa to spend time at small museums, she said. But she never imagined herself actually running a museum. Quote, when I was a kid, I wanted to be either a stewardess or a spy, she recalled, laughing. After graduating from high school, she spent a year working at General Telephone before attending the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls and preparing for a career as a high school history teacher. She interned at the UNI Museum before interning at the Grout. Quote, once I was here, I was hooked, Bailey said. Co-directors Margot Dundon and Lois Whitmore became her mentors and hired her when she graduated from UNI in 1979 with a bachelor's degree in history. Over the years, Bailey has worked in almost every museum department, including education, collections, exhibits, and programming, and served as volunteer coordinator, registrar, archivist, and assistant director. Quote, I've done all the jobs except janitorial. And after Lois retired and Margot took over and then left for a position in Florida, I was named interim director. Later, she was named Grout Museum District Director. In 1985, Bailey was one of the founders of Resources Plus, a consortium of Blackhawk County's cultural agencies. She was elected president of the Iowa Museum Association in 1991. Bailey received the Iowa Museum Association Leadership Award in 2019, recognizing her outstanding contributions to the museum field. Post-pandemic, museums across the nation continue struggling to find adequate funding and reach audiences. Another major challenge, Bailey said, quote, is changing public perception. Museums are seen as a nice thing to have, a want, not a need. I firmly believe museums and libraries, too, are needs in a community. But they aren't perceived in that manner. I want people to understand the importance of history, the need to know history, she explained. Quote, people need to learn about the history of their community, their state, region, county, and the world. History requires reflection. Museums are where we go to reflect on the creative nature of humankind, unquote. John Deere profits hit new record for third year, but stock prices fall on fear that leaner times are ahead. Story was written by Courier staff, and the dateline is Moline, Illinois. Deere and Company raked in record earnings for the quarter and the fiscal year. The company reported Wednesday, the third straight year of record performance. But the agricultural and construction equipment maker warned leaner times are ahead as higher interest rates are expected to cut into sales. Wall Street took notice. Deere stock plunged more than 3% Wednesday to close at $370.76, down $11.89 per share. Deere reported net income of $2.369 billion for the fourth quarter ending October 29th, and that is $8.26 per share compared with net income of $2.246 billion, or $7.44 per share, for the quarter ended October 30, 2022. That was well above industry estimates. For fiscal year 2023, net income attributable to John Deere & Company was $10.166 billion, or 34.63 cents per share, compared with $7.131 billion, or 23.28 cents per share in fiscal 2022. Worldwide net sales and revenues decreased 1% for the fourth quarter of fiscal 2023 and rose 16% for the full year. Net sales were $13.8 billion for the quarter and $55.565 billion for the year, compared with $14.351 billion and $47.917 billion in 2022. Quote, Deere's fourth quarter and full year results can be attributed to the successful execution of our Smart Industrial operating model and the value that customers recognize in our industry-leading products and solutions, John C. May, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, said in a news release, quote, We must also recognize and credit our dedicated employees, dealers, and suppliers, whose hard work and focus have been instrumental to our overall success. Net income attributable to Deere & Company for fiscal 2024 is forecasted to be in the range of $7.75 billion to $8.25 billion. That would be a sharp drop in profitability from the nearly $10.2 billion for fiscal 2023 that was reported on Wednesday. The company predicted a return to mid-cycle sales levels. Quote, While our end markets will fluctuate, we remain focused on disciplined execution and strategically investing in solutions that drive customer value, May said. As evidenced by our guidance for 2024, we are demonstrating higher levels of through-cycle structural profitability while making our company more resilient and better equipped for the future, unquote. Minutes from the Federal Reserve's October 31st, November 1st meeting, released Tuesday, noted higher interest rates were affecting the agricultural sector. According to Investor's Business Daily, members of the Fed's policy committee said their contacts noted that high financing costs were likely weighing on purchases of heavy agricultural equipment. Waterloo woman arrested for trying to set car on fire. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline, Waterloo. A Waterloo woman has been arrested for allegedly dousing a vehicle in gasoline and attempting to set it on fire in 2022. Black Hawk County Sheriff's deputies arrested 36-year-old Tiana Brisha Monique Ford of 734 Wellington Street on Monday on a warrant for one count of second-degree arson. She was also arrested on a parole violation warrant, and bond was set at $25,000. According to court records, Ford was involved in an argument in the 1400 block of Mulberry Street on August 1st. She had a bottle of gasoline and sprayed it on a person. She then sprayed it on the interior of a 2006 Buick and tried to ignite it by lighting a cigarette and throwing it in the vehicle, court records state. This isn't the first time Ford has been arrested for allegedly trying to set something on fire. In March 2017, she poured gasoline on a woman and the woman's sport utility vehicle while children were inside the vehicle in the 700 block of Logan Avenue. Ford attempted to light a cigarette near the vehicle, but the woman chased her off, according to court records. She was sentenced to up to 10 years in prison for arson, and she was released from prison in October 2020. Man flees halfway house. Dateline Waterloo. Authorities are seeking the public's help in locating a Waterloo man who allegedly fled from a halfway house where he was serving time for a robbery in Olwine. Tyron James Jones, 24, failed to report back to the Waterloo Residential Correctional Facility on November 17th, according to officials with the Iowa Department of Corrections. He had been sentenced to up to 10 years in prison in a January 2017 incident where he beat a man with a pistol and stole marijuana, according to court records. Jones was placed on work release on October 12, 2023. He is described as a 24-year-old black male, 6 feet 3 inches tall, and weighing 198 pounds. Anyone with information on Jones's whereabouts should contact local police. Traffic stop results in firearms charges. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested on gun charges following a traffic stop on Monday. Police stopped a Chevrolet Impala for a traffic violation at Logan Avenue and Almond Street at around 12:40 p.m. Officers noted the 20-year-old occupant was smoking a cigarette, but wasn't the legal age to possess cigarettes, which is 21. Police searched the car and found a loaded 9mm Taurus pistol with an extended magazine under the front passenger seat. Trayvon Lamar Reed, 20, was arrested for felon in possession of a firearm. Bond was set at $10,000. Police said Reed is prohibited from handling firearms because of a felony conviction for intimidation with a weapon in an October 2020 incident where he opened fire on a car with a person inside. Man faces drug charges after motorcycle chase. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz, and the dateline is Waterloo. Police arrested a Waterloo man following a brief motorcycle chase early Wednesday. An officer noticed the Kawasaki motorcycle driving on the sidewalk without a taillight in the area of Lafayette and Ray Streets at around 1:10 a.m. and attempted to stop it. The vehicle sped off and the driver dismounted about four blocks later in the 200 block of Cottage Grove Avenue. Officers found the driver hidden in a backyard and he ran away but was detained a short time later. Police found more than 5 grams of meth and a glass pipe on the driver, according to court records. One officer received a minor injury to a hand while jumping a fence during the chase. Police arrested Jason John Cummings, 300 Linden Avenue, on charges of eluding, interference, causing injury, possession of meth with intent to deliver, and violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act. Next, we have an installment in the Courier's 20 Under 40 series. Janae Gui, volunteer, continues to give back to her community in multiple ways. Dateline Cedar Falls. Some experiences leave an impression and last a lifetime. When Janae Gui, 32, of Cedar Falls, was younger, she had two older siblings who enrolled at the University of Northern Iowa. While visiting them, the music enthusiast remembers making a few stops at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. Quote, "I really liked music. I played the piano and flute growing up, and I had heard some of the music, and it was fun environment," she said. In 2010, the Marion native became a UNI student and remembers taking advantage of free student tickets to the GB PAC shows. She also volunteered at the Northeast Iowa Food Bank at least once per month as part of Volunteer Tuesdays, an initiative she helped lead. That was the start of something special. Gui, who graduated from UNI in 2013, is now a 20 under 40 recipient, honored for both her extensive volunteer work and impressive career in finance and accounting. She's president of the Friends of the Gallagher Blue Dorn. She still volunteers her time at Northeast Iowa Food Bank and brings others along for the experience. Quote, "Not only does she bring her enthusiasm to the board, she is also able to keep other board members excited and willing to volunteer for many activities," wrote Kelly McCarthy in nominating Gui. Quote, "She keeps multiple committees organized and on the right track for achieving the goals of the board while at the same time working a full-time plus job of traveling and meetings. She is passionate about anything that she agrees to do, and everything turns to gold when she is involved," unquote. The Performing Arts Center's Kaleidoscope Series is one of Gui's favorite to support. The program strives to provide children multiple performing arts opportunities that they wouldn't normally get. That may be through a school field trip or for the Buck a Kid program. Quote, "If you volunteer at the plays, then you get to see the kids get bussed, walk to Gallagher, and then they look up in awe as they come into the lobby," she said. It's the impact on the kids that also keeps her volunteering at the food bank. Quote, "One of my favorites is their backpack program," she said. "It's knowing that so many kids in our community don't know what they're going to eat on the weekend. I think that program is very important," unquote. A particularly meaningful experience played a big role in her wanting to continue her work as a volunteer. While she was a college student, a man came to volunteer at the food bank despite having experienced a serious injury and trauma, leaving him disabled. Quote, "He still came and volunteered," said Quay, admiring his desire to give back to the community. Quote, "That definitely shapes things for you." Quay also volunteers through Perry Lakes Church in Cedar Falls. She spends time on Wednesdays helping facilitate middle school Bible study. Her small group is comprised of 6 girls, but the church's pride in welcoming and going above and beyond to form relationships has led her to take the role a step farther. Quote, "I also will try to attend these girls' own events outside the small group. The point is so that they have an adult leader outside of their home that they know they can count on," Quay said. She and her husband, Rusty, as well as dog Charlie and cat Chrissy, also make a difference in the lives of kids in other ways. They previously were foster parents and now provide respite care in support of those families needing temporary child care. Quote, "When I think of the future of Cedar Valley, I hope it is filled with S heroes like Janae, someone who is committed to making sure our community is taken care of," wrote Angela Weekly of Waterloo in nominating Quay. Quay earned accounting certificates and her master's in business administration from the University of Iowa in Iowa City after graduating from UNI. She has advanced at CPM Holdings Incorporated after starting there in 2017 as an assistant controller of the business unit. She was promoted to controller of the business unit and later became an assistant controller at the corporate level. She remembers the company being a sort of tech dinosaur when she first started, paying out $1 million a week in paper checks. Finances are now handled 95% electronically. And her passion for volunteering doesn't rest while she's at work. She'll bring her team along as a team-building activity. Quote, "It gets everybody out of the work setting, and you get to know people more. Those small conversations that come up, and then you're serving your community together, and that brings out a different perspective," she explained. CF officials to hold goal-setting sessions. Dateline Cedar Falls. And this story was written by Andy Malone. The discussions, often referred to by city officials as goal-setting, kick off Monday. These lengthy, more informal public meetings are used reportedly by the professional staff to gauge from elected officials the city's direction and priorities when it comes to budgeting and action items at future city council meetings. Topics aside, they will be different from the 2022 meetings for 2 reasons. Last year, only 2 sessions were scheduled and took a little longer than 5 hours each to wrap up. This year, they've been broken into 4 and are expected to be shorter. They've been scheduled for 4 to 7 p.m. Monday and Thursday, as well as December 7th and 11th at the Community Center at 528 Main Street. The other difference comes in terms of personnel composition. Not only are Mayor Rob Green and the 7 members of the council invited to attend and participate, along with the department heads, but so are Mayor-elect Danny Laudick and council members-elect Chris Lada, Aaron Hawbaker, and Hannah Chrisman. No public comment is offered during these sessions, however. They are more informal and during breaks from discussions may allow for residents and other stakeholders to approach officials outside the scheduled discussions. The Monday agenda has been posted online and includes discussion of work session ground rules, discussion of goal-setting process, review of questionnaire responses completed by officials, identifying priorities, explanation of next steps and timeline. That first session will largely set the course for the future sessions. They've not been broadcast in the past, but last year was the first year the audio had been recorded and later uploaded to YouTube. Coats for Kids seeks donation for winter gear distribution across the Cedar Valley. Story by Angela Sturm McLaughlin, and it begins with a photograph of Mackenzie McGee as she checks her ensemble in the mirror during the Coats for Kids event at Becker Elementary School in Waterloo on December 3rd of 2019, and she looks very pleased with her ensemble. Dateline Waterloo. As colder temperatures reach the Cedar Valley, Coats for Kids is gearing up to provide coats, scarves, gloves, and other winter weather gear to children from low-income families. Founded by Julie Ehlers in 2012, Coats for Kids has provided nearly 21,000 winter gear items to students at 34 schools in Cedar Falls, Evansdale, Gilbertville, Hudson, and Waterloo. This labor of love started when she heard the students in the Waterloo Community Schools did not have adequate winter coats. Quote, I heard there was a need for winter gear for our local kids. The first year we shared 180 coats, and it's grown from there, Eiler said. To date, the project has distributed 9,531 coats, 6,718 pair of boots, and 4,604 snow pants to children. Ehlers said giving to Coats for Kids is easy. Quote, gifts of $30, $50, $70 or more will ensure that one kid or many kids will be warm this winter, she said. A gift of $30 will allow a child to choose a new warm coat in their favorite color, along with hat, gloves, and a scarf. A new coat, hat, gloves, scarf, and a pair of boots can be purchased with a gift of $50. For $70, a child gets everything needed to play in the snow, coat, boots, snow pants, hat, gloves, scarf. Groups can also participate by purchasing these new items and donating them to the effort. As the need for donations has grown, Ehlers said there are other ways for people in the community to help out, even if they do not have the means to give financially. Quote, Coats for Kids currently has three thoughtful women that knit throughout the year to provide the beautiful hats and scarves for our kids. We would like to encourage other knitters in the community to make these items for our kids, she said. Quote, our community always prioritizes our kids' well-being, so with the community support, you will have an opportunity to have an impact on kids attending schools in Black Hawk County, Ehlers said. To give to Coats for Kids, mail a donation to Waterloo Community Foundation at P.O. Box 1253, and the zip code is 50704, or learn more about the organization online at facebook.com/coatsforkids.waterloo. And Coats is spelled with a K, and 4 is the numeral 4, so it's coatsforkids.waterloo. And now, listeners, at this time we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, November 27th, on IRIS, that's I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Judith Judy Moser, 83, a resident at Edgewood Retirement Community in West Des Moines, died peacefully in her sleep with her family by her side on Tuesday, November 21st, 2023, after succumbing to Alzheimer's disease. Born Judith Lee Justine Silwester on September 1st, 1940, at Mary Greeley Hospital in Ames, Iowa, Judy was the daughter of Alice Victoria Brogan and Erhard Dutch Sylvester. Judy graduated from Ames High School in 1958, receiving a BA degree in education from Iowa State University. She then completed her student teaching at the John Tracy Clinic in Los Angeles, California. For 5 years, she worked as a K-5 deaf and hearing impaired teacher in the Arlington Heights School District near Chicago, followed by 2 years as a teacher at Longfellow and Lincoln Elementary Schools within the Waterloo Community Schools. Judy married Gordon Lou Moser on February 11, 1968, at Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church in Waterloo, Iowa. She became a homemaker, where she raised her two daughters, Jennifer and Kelly, and supported her husband's endeavors as the owner and operator at Portavet Industries, Inc. Judy loved to stay active, so volunteering in the community played a large role in her life. She was a PTA board member with Waterloo Community Schools, a meal server with the Salvation Army, a blood drive volunteer with the Red Cross, a troop leader for the Girl Scouts of America, and a NICU baby ward volunteer at Allen Memorial Hospital. Judy played an active role at Zion Lutheran Church as an event organizer, a Sunday school and Bible school teacher, a baptism banner maker, and a member of the women's circle. She was known to check in on her elderly friends, take care of friends' homes when they left town, and bring food over for friends in need. Judy and Gordy enjoyed entertaining guests at their cabin overlooking the Mississippi River in DeSoto, Wisconsin. They rarely missed NCAA wrestling tournaments or the Drake Relays. Avid travelers, they cruised the Panama Canal, explored Alaska and Hawaii, took overnight trains across the country, and slept in every U.S. state. Judy once visited her daughters in Japan and later went on a genealogy tour with her siblings in England. For 20 years, she arranged annual trips with her Ames High School Women of 58 classmates, which included stays on West Coast islands, monasteries in the north, New England beach houses, Italian villas, and Scottish castles. A nature lover, Judy could tell you the name of every bird, flower, tree, bush, or weed. She grew up on an acreage with large vegetable and flower gardens and replicated that landscape for her own family. Besides gardening, other hobbies included canning pears, pickles, and salsa, making jam, and collecting maple syrup. She enjoyed quilting, sewing costumes, antiquing, ceramic painting, cake decorating, dollhouse furniture collecting, reading books about World War II, seeing Les Miserables in the theater, going to movies based on true stories, cheering on the Cyclones, beautifully playing the piano by ear, reciting practically every verse from the church hymnal, starting every day with an aerobics class, and spending time with her grandsons. She also found time to take care of many pets over the years, including a toy poodle, 5 cats, 5 Labrador retrievers, newts, guinea fowl, and exotic fish. Judy's motto was, "Give it away," and she will be remembered for her generosity on birthdays, weddings, graduations, hospital stays, and funerals. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, December 2, 2023, at 11 o'clock a.m., at Lock at Tower Park, 4140 Kimball Avenue in Waterloo, Iowa. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery, 3430 West 4th Street in Waterloo, Iowa. The family would like to invite those in attendance to join them for a luncheon and reception back at Lock at Tower Park at the conclusion of the burial. Visit www.lockfuneralservices.com to leave condolences. In Cedar Falls, Beverly M. Haugen, 96, of Cedar Falls, died Sunday, November 19th, at Mercy One Medical Center in Waterloo. She was born on July 20th, 1927, in Denison, Minnesota, daughter of Ben and Mabel Comprud Hillestad. She married Arlen X. Haugen on August 21st, 1948, in Denison, Minnesota. Bev graduated from Northfield High School and Minneapolis Business College. She was a homemaker until her children graduated from high school. Bev was an Avon representative for 25 years and also coordinated drivers for the Meals on Wheels program for 12 years. She was a charter member and past president of the Sons of Norway Saugglimt Lodge. Bev and X joined Nazareth Lutheran Church in 1959 and were faithful and active members for 64 years. The funeral service for Bev will be at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, November 25th, at Nazareth Lutheran Church, Larson Chapel, with the visitation from 9:30 a.m. until the time of the service at the church on Saturday. Burial will be at Fairview Cemetery. Dahl Van Hoof Schoof Funeral Home is assisting the family. Memorials may be directed to Nazareth Lutheran Church Mission Fund and the House of Hope in Waterloo. Bev was a beloved wife, mother, grandma, and friend. She loved flowers, gardening, and her bridge clubs, and was known for making delicious pies and potato salad. She will be missed by many. Nancy Jane Price, 98, poet and novelist of Cedar Falls, Iowa, died November 20th in Waterloo, Iowa. Nancy was born March 16th, 1925, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the first child of Mary Emily Day and Malcolm Poyer Price. Her much younger brother, John, eventually completed their family. She spent her childhood in Detroit, Michigan, where she attended Edsel Ford's Children's House, a center for young artists and writers. Her first poems were printed in the Detroit News when she was 14. In 1940, the family moved to Cedar Falls, Iowa, where Malcolm Price became president of Iowa State Teachers College. Nancy graduated from Cornell College and married Howard John Thompson of Cedar Falls, who received his doctorate from Harvard. Nancy and her husband taught at the University of Northern Iowa. As their three children, Catherine, John, and David, grew, Nancy studied with poets John Holmes and Philip Booth in Boston and attended the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. More than 100 of her poems and stories appeared in hardback books, national magazines, and journals. Nancy received a fellowship from the National Endowment of the Arts and was given writer residence at the Rockefeller Foundation Center in Italy, the Carolli Foundation in France, and the Throne Guthrie Center in Ireland. She was a professor at the University of Northern Iowa until 1968, when she was given a leave to write her first novel, A Natural Death, a story of South Carolina life before the Civil War, published by the Atlantic Monthly Press, Little Brown, in 1973. More than a dozen novels by Nancy Price have been published, and some have been translated into 18 languages. She has illustrated many of her books, as well as a volume of her poems. Her third novel, Sleeping with the Enemy, became a 20th Century Fox film starring Julia Roberts. Nancy was able to travel for extended periods, going alone or with her family to England a dozen times, as well as to Scandinavia, Europe, Egypt, and the Holy Land. John Howard Thompson, Nancy's eldest son, died in 2005, 10 years after his father. Nancy bought a home in Cedar Falls, close to her two remaining children, and wrote into her late 90s, surrounded and encouraged by family and friends. She recently finished her final novel in Cedar Falls, which will be published in about a year. Her gravestone bears words from one of her poems about Cedar Falls. Nancy Price loved Iowa. Her novels are often set in Cedar Falls and Waterloo. A young city girl in one of Nancy's books, No One Knows, sees Iowa for the first time. Quote, "I had never dreamed of anything like Iowa. Chicago streets were dark canyons, and Chicago skies were only glimpses of blue or gray. But Iowa buildings, houses, and barns were almost lost under a sky I had hardly known was there. It made me feel small. It made me feel free. Iowa's green gave way to flowers or the purple-black of shaded trees or the lavenders of far-off farmland. Trains ran through town, trailing their long, lamenting voices behind them like blue scarves." These colors of Iowa will always continue to live in Nancy Price's novels, stories, and poems. In Hudson, Cecil Edward Holmes, 94, of Hudson, met his savior and was reunited with his wife on Friday, November 17th. He was born on May 10th, 1929, on the family farm northeast of Hudson, the son of Dale and Grace Frank Holmes. Cecil graduated from Hudson High School in 1947 and worked on the farm. When things were slow, Cecil would go to town and work for Howard Cornelius in his blacksmith shop. In 1957, he purchased the blacksmith shop, and thus was born Holmes Welding and Fabrication, Ltd., where he retired at age 86. Cecil married his lifelong sweetheart, Kathleen Ann Holmes, on July 12, 1949, and the union was blessed with five children. Cecil used to laugh that he and Kathleen had four children in 33 months, and then they got a TV. Cecil was a soft-spoken, non-confrontational man who said what he meant and did what he said. Yet, he despised change, even if it were something as simple as moving his recliner in the living room. He believed success in marriage was predicated on not going to bed mad and having a short memory. As a blacksmith, Cecil loved mentoring young blacksmiths, especially his son Jim. He was active with the Blacksmith Association and served as president of the chapter, state, and national associations. He was named Blacksmith of the Year in 1964. Cecil was a member of El Cahir Shrine and Coin Lodge with the Masons. An accident on the farm caused Cecil to lose his left ring finger, which prompted him to tell the grandkids to, quote, "give me four." He loved pulling the kids around on sleds using the three-wheeler, what they called crack the whip. Cecil served on the Hudson Fire Department for 10 years. He enjoyed target shooting and shooting off fireworks in the burn barrel, especially acetylene bombs. Funeral services for Cecil will be held Wednesday, November 29th at 10:30 a.m. at the Community Church of Hudson, 226 Eldora Road, Hudson, with private family burial in the Hudson Cemetery. The family will receive friends on Tuesday, November 28th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at Lock at Tower Park, 4140 Kimball Avenue in Waterloo. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions should be directed to the Community Church of Hudson or Cedar Valley Hospice. Online condolences may be expressed at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Jim Brock Alexander, 80, of Waterloo, Iowa, departed this life on Saturday, November 18th, at North Crest Specialty Care in Waterloo, Iowa, of natural causes. He was born March 30, 1943, at St. Louis, Missouri, the son of Brock and Mentha Alexander. Jim married Mary Lee Carr in Waterloo, Iowa, in 1963, but later divorced. Jim then married Alta Smith in Waterloo, Iowa, in 1971, and they later divorced. Jim attended East High School and participated with the track and field team and wrestling team, where he was part of the graduating class in 1961. Jim was employed as a machinist at John Deere for 30 years, retiring in 1990. Jim was extremely unique, and his charming personality was contagious. His infectious smile lit up a room when he walked in. The simplest pleasures in life brought great joy to him. He enjoyed hunting, golf, traveling, watching old cowboy western shows, sports, and, more importantly, drag racing. He truly was a car enthusiast, to say the least. Jim was a jokester who had no boundaries between normal interactions and regular life. This was a good thing. He always provided a laugh because he could find humor in the most mundane life circumstances. Services for Jim will be at 11 o'clock a.m. on Monday, November 27th, that's today, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street, with burial in Fairview Cemetery. Public visitation will be from 9 o'clock a.m. until the time of the service. Memorials and cards may be sent to 521 Boston, Waterloo, Iowa, 50703. Family will receive friends beginning at 9 o'clock a.m. on Monday at the funeral home. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Robert Charles Oliphant, 81, died on Friday, November 17th. He was born on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7, 1941, in Waterloo, Iowa. He graduated from Waterloo West High School in 1959. From 1962 to 1966, he served in the United States Army, first in Herzogenaurach, Germany, in Fort Hachua in Arizona. He returned to Waterloo shortly thereafter and became an inspector at John Deere, while simultaneously attending classes at Northern Iowa University. He moved to Germany with his family in 1973, where he held the title of sales director, before returning to the U.S. in 1987. Robert lived in the Chicago area while working as a counselor until 2012, whereas upon retirement, he returned to his hometown of Waterloo. Funeral services for Robert will not be held upon his request. Military rites will be observed at the time of interment. Go to www.lockfuneralservices.com to leave condolences. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from Steve Corbin, who is a professor emeritus at the University of Northern Iowa. And the Courier notes here that the opinions expressed in this article are those of the author and do not reflect those of the University of Northern Iowa. On September 18, 1787, the last day of the U.S. Constitutional Convention, James McHenry, of Maryland delegate, asked Benjamin Franklin, quote, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" Franklin's reply, quote, "A republic, if you can keep it," is profound. Not only does our democracy depend upon the supreme power of its residents and their elective representatives, but for America to survive, it depends upon citizens to become actively involved in the selection of its elected delegates. So, what's the problem? The Pew Research Center reports America's voting turnout ranks an underwhelming 31st out of 50 countries who exhibit solid democratic traditions. While the 2020 presidential election had the highest voter turnout of the 21st century at 66.7%, it's sad that one out of every three people you meet on the street didn't partake in our attempt to keep a republic. In the past six general elections, 2000 through 2020, the average turnout rate of registered voters for primary elections was 27%, while the average turnout rate for general elections was slightly over 60%. That means more than half, 55%, of the general election voters did not vote in primary elections. For midterm primary elections, it's worse. About 80% of eligible voters do not partake in primary elections. What's the significance of this data? Low voter participation in caucus primary elections means a smaller subset of voters, most likely far left-wing crazies and far right-wing wackos, hoodwinked by candidate disinformation, misinformation, far-fetched promises, propaganda, and/or sinister political agendas, may be playing an outsized role in determining the final candidates. Let's face it, we may be electing self-centered, party-before-the-people politicians, allegiant to their financial supporters, simply because we're not active, like Franklin feared, in all elections. We only have ourselves to blame if we're represented by less than desirable, narcissistic, divisive, rude, opponent-bashing, retribution-oriented, racist, anti-bipartisan, anti-trade, anti-democracy, anti-constitution, and pro-authoritarian delegates. Let's review a couple caucus primary election examples. Joe Biden ran for president 3 different times and didn't win his first caucus primary election until February 28th of 2020, when he defeated Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in South Carolina. Biden was one of 22 candidates and has been a politician since 1971. Donald Trump, who has changed party affiliation 5 times, was a presidential candidate in 2000 with the Reform Party. A 2020 study, Journal of Politics, revealed voters had the most difficulty assessing the ideology of Trump in the 2016 election out of all presidential candidates since 1972 and all contemporary legislators. Trump was one of 17 candidates seeking the GOP presidential nomination. Were Biden and or Trump the best candidates for their respective parties, or the winner only because a small subset of rabid fanatical Democrats or rabid extremist Republicans voted while the majority of voters didn't partake in the caucus primary election? What can you do to help America remain a democracy and select the best candidates? Be proactive. Go to www.270towin.com's 2024 presidential election calendar to find out the precise date of your caucus or primary election and vote. Next, mark your calendar to also vote on November 5th of 2024. Officials within your political party of preference, as well as your county and state auditor, can assist with any voting inquiry. The first of 15 caucuses and 53 primary elections begins January 15th. Heed the words of Thomas Jefferson, quote, "We do not have government by the majority. We have government by the majority who participate." Be in the majority by voting in the caucus, primary, and general elections, or don't complain about the religious, cultural, and political zealot elected politicians we must endure for another 2 to 4 years, who purposely could be seeking office to change America from a republic to a monarchy. Now back to local news from the Courier. Panther West Development gets zoning panel green light. Dozens of homes could be built near Aldridge. Story filed by Andy Malone, Dateline Cedar Falls. The Planning and Zoning Commission granted a favorable recommendation Wednesday for westward residential growth. The commission voted 5-0 to support minor changes to developer Brent Dahlstrom's plans for dozens of single-family homes and critical road connections on 54.79 acres north of Bess Streeter Aldridge Elementary School and south of Greenhill Road. Commissioners Oksana Guibovich Hafferman, Brad Leeper, and Amanda Lynch were absent. The parcel, known as Panther West, would go from R1 Residence District to MU Mixed Use Residential District to RP Planned Residence District, if approved by the City Council on December 18th. Quote, the RP District allows flexibility in the types of dwelling, lot sizes, building heights, and setbacks. But this plan the applicant is proposing restricts the development to detached single-family dwellings, said planner J. Devsinch Atodaria. Dahlstrom's company, Panther Builders, had the land zoned R1 Residence District and MU Mixed-Use Residential District Multi-Use Development with plans for 14.18 acres to be more diverse development, residential and professional office space. Approximately 40 acres had been planned for single-family home lots. The proposed rezoning request, however, is not consistent with the city's comprehensive plan and the future land use map, meaning the applicant also has to change the designations of, quote, neighborhood commercial and mixed use and greenways and floodplain use to low-density residential. The staff is still placing an emphasis on preservation of environmentally sensitive areas and crucial scenic corridors. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, November 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.